Hello and welcome to another summer edition of the Three Bid League podcast. As always, I'm your host, Tyler. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, the head coach of the George Mason Patriots, Kim English. Coach, thank you for joining me.
What's up, Tyler? Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, so we're here basically at the end of August. Summer practice is over. You've gotten plenty of time to get to see this new roster and all of these new players come together. So coming out of that and looking ahead to next season, what is one thing that has you really excited about this combination of players?
I'm much more excited about our depth than I was, halfway through and towards the end of last season. I just felt like our guys wore down. So, I'm excited about the depth, the talent that we have at multiple positions. And, what I want that to do for our overall, areas of emphasis and habits that, we can make substitutions. Now, outside of rotational substitutions, but substitutions for falling below our level or our standard that we want to uphold. So I think that our depth will have effects on other areas of our program in a positive way.
Yeah, and is there a young guy on this team outside of your four returning starters or some of your older transfers like Victor Bailey Jr.? Is there a young player who might be coming off the bench this season that you think had a particularly impressive summer?
I think everyone had their moments. I think everyone had their moments. We have four freshmen, Peter Duro, Devin Dinkins, Justin Fernandez, and Emeka Najee. I think all four of those guys had great moments this summer. I think Devin had a really, really, really good summer. And I think Justin, who has been here since Christmas a year ago, has continued to grow astronomically. His body, his maturity, his patience on both sides of the ball is showing. And, but again, really excited about all those guys.
Yeah, and Justin Fernandez is a name that I think A-10 fans have already become familiar with, given that he is a top 100 rated recruit. So even people outside of Fairfax know that name by now. Came in January, like you said, got a whole extra semester over the rest of these guys. What are the kind of things you feel like he can contribute to this team immediately with a bunch of veterans around him?
Well, his athleticism is awesome, and he's best when he gets to play in transition. So I think he's just going to offer us a great spark. And as the more he defends, the more opportunity he'll have to play offensive basketball, and more particularly in transition when he's at his best. I think he's a really good shooter, but his athleticism is what's most special about him offensively.
Yeah, and he's got good size for his position too. Someone that certainly in my research has come across as a guy that can really, really help you space the floor. So if he can help in transition and athletically too, then sounds like a pretty gifted young player.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's the goal. You want to create opportunities in long closeout situations, and you want to score as quick as you can in transition. So absolutely.
Yeah, and for anyone who listens to this pod normally, we're obviously missing a voice. My co-host, Matt, unable to be on right now, but he left me with some great questions for you. And one of his best, we just talked about Justin Fernandez and all these other young guys. How do you as a coach manage a group of very talented freshmen with returning players and a few grad transfers when you're going about practice and thinking about your rotations? Like, how do you develop these guys when there's a lot of experienced players ahead of them who are deserving of plenty of minutes?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's seniority doesn't grant you minutes or a starting job, or anything like that. Everything's going to be earned. So, I mean, if a freshman earns it, he earns it and he's going to get it. It's democracy in that sense. It's a meritocracy rather, in that you're and they know that. They know that. I don't coach VJ Bailey or Genika Ogiako any differently than I do Devin Dinkins or Peter Duro.
Is it ever a challenge, though, if there's a freshman, and you certainly do not have to name any specific names, but if there's a freshman who, just by virtue of being a young player, maybe is on the back end of that rotation, how do you make sure that that guy's getting the proper practice time so that he can keep growing his game and be a future asset?
No, that's a great question. Player development is I think it's the best thing we do as a program, is developing our guys. Player development is more than half of what we do from a basketball standpoint. Practices, we work on our games, our guys get better, and the numbers proved it. You know, a lot of our guys had the best seasons of their careers. But it's incredibly important, because the retention of our athletes has become so important. You know, it's not just about signing transfers. It's still about developing the homegrown talent. And individual work after practice, work during practice. You know, if they're out of the rotation, work on the scout team. I've seen it. You know, I've seen, you know, Eve Pons and John Fulkerson at Tennessee play behind Grant Williams and Admiral Schofield, and then step into those roles the next year, Eve being the SEC Defensive Player of the Year and John Fulkerson being first team all Southeastern Conference. You know, so I've seen it a bunch at Tennessee, what it looks like on a day-to-day basis. And it's, you know, you and it's easy. It's easy for a kid to be in that position and just say, I'm leaving. So it absolutely takes relationships, communication with the kid and everyone around him to make sure that it's understood what his current role is and what his future role could be if he sticks with it at the respective program. No example better than that for us is Malik Henry. Malik had some great moments last seasons in games, but he had as good of a summer as I've seen in my 8 years coaching. And he was incredible this summer. And, you know, he has two really good big men that are in the front court, you know, with them, really, really good, and Josh and Genica, you know. So, you know, to be determined, you know, how much he's going to play, but he's absolutely in the plans of our program this season and beyond.
Yeah, and he's someone who, I think, to anyone who wasn't watching every single Mason game, kind of fell by the wayside of our minds. He wasn't playing a ton at the end of the year. And so that's a perfect example of a guy who didn't leave because he wasn't getting many minutes. He stayed, and now sounds like he could be a huge contributor for this year's team. So that's a credit to him for working hard.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I want to flip it now to the opposite end of the age spectrum, because you have a pretty old roster, actually. And part of that is these grad transfers you brought in, one of whom is Victor Bailey Jr., who you knew from your time as an assistant coach at Tennessee. He's got 1 year of eligibility left. And this weird thing has happened this summer that a lot of people who follow the A-10, myself included, I guess just because of his size, thought that this guy was going to be a point guard. And you have mentioned before on the By George pod that's absolutely not what his role is. So please enlighten myself and everyone listening as to what he's going to bring to this team.
Yeah, I mean, he's 6'4". I mean, he's a 6'4", you know, athletic shooting guard. You know, he'll play, he can play point. He did play point for us in pinches at Tennessee. You know, I think as he transitions into a professional player, he'll play more and more point guard. But VJ's wired. He's wired to score. It's the best thing he does. You know, he led us in scoring my last season at Tennessee, you know, all the way up until like our last two or three games when Jaden Springer and Keon Johnson surpassed him by a few points, I think. But no, he's our point guards are Devin, Ronald Polite, and Saquon Sampson.
Yeah, and for anyone not familiar, those guys that you mentioned, Jaden Springer and Keon Johnson, both went on to be top 20 NBA draft picks that year. So certainly two talented players that he was running with the Volunteers. So I assume that he'll be a guy who's going to play a lot of minutes next to Davon Cooper then.
Yeah, they'll play together. I mean, they'll play alongside each other some. It's not so, you know, in my eyes, rotations and lineups aren't so like, you know, yeah, they're going to play with each other. They're going to play, one will be on the bench some, but one, I mean, you know, we just, it's a pot, you know, it's a pot. It's a recipe that you're doing things, putting it together until you find that group that works best and what you're looking for. You know, are we looking for rebound? Are we looking for defense? Are we looking for shooting? Are we looking for drivers? Are we looking for ball handlers? You know, depend on it, you know, depending on what lineup we run with. But yes, VJ Bailey and Davon Cooper can and will absolutely play together.
Yeah, and you mentioned all those skills you're looking for. And this is a guy that I think most of our listeners know very well, but I can't have a chance to talk to you without bringing up one of my favorite guys to watch in the A-10. And that's Ticket Gaines, man who moves and shoots like a wing and rebounds like a center. And as you start to put together this deeper roster and you try to find which of these pieces can be malleable together, Ticket Gaines, the way he fits into this equation, do you think much about, oh, I got to put him here, or he's going to pair well with this guy? Or is he somebody that you feel like you can just kind of throw on the court and just ask him to do what you need?
Yeah, Ticket played the 1 through 5 for us last season. He can play all over the court. I think thought he had great success last season at the 4, being that he had a mismatch at all times and he could, you know, break free for catch and shoot opportunities from 3. But I think he wore down the season on. I think he was playing like 3 minutes a game at Tennessee to playing 35 minutes a game for us. So I just think as the season went down, that's why his shooting numbers went from 52% to 41% from 3. And he was a top 20 shooter in the country for most of the season. And he fell towards the end down to a very respectable 41%. But he'll get opportunities to play more on the perimeter this season, but he'll also play at the 4 as well. But wanted to find opportunities to get him rest, which, you know, signing Geneko Giako was an opportunity to move Josh Aduro to play some 4, which would give him a break. Blake Jones, as he continues to develop, it's another guy that could help give him some rest. If we can get Ticket's minutes that from 30, I think he was like at 33, 34 minutes a game. If he could get into the high 20s, I just think the quality of his minutes and the output of his energy will be better.
Yeah, and even with that fall off that you mentioned at the end of the season, he still finished as the second highest shooting non-guard from 3 in the A-10. The guy above him was the player of the year in Luka Brajkovic, so a pretty impressive season nonetheless. You brought up Blake Jones. That's someone that I'm very interested in. I basically classified him last year as an intriguing mystery. The intrigue coming from the fact that he's a 6'11 guy who can shoot and looks like a good fit next to a guy like Josh Aduro, but he didn't play a ton. And so it was kind of tough for me just watching on my TV to get much of a gauge of the rest of his skill set. So outside of the jumper, what else do you think we could see from him this year?
What he does is, and it's he's an analytical darling, you know, when you look at lineup efficiency. That's really what he is. You know, he does a lot of things that you wouldn't see when you're watching a film, but he understands the spacing of our offense perfectly. He knows absolutely everything we want to do offensively from a set standpoint, from positions 2 through 5. And it's an adjustment. It's a real adjustment for international freshmen. It is a different game. It is a completely different game from what he experienced, you know, at the Institute, from what he experienced at the NBL, what he experienced in FIBA competition. I chalk it up to, you know, his lack of great efficiency shooting the ball figuring it out as a freshman. That's a curve. I thought he had a great summer. I think he's improving. He has no chance, no choice, except for to get more physical, right? The big guys that he's battling with, Josh Aduro, Geneko Ogiako, Malik Henry, Elvis Najee, Peter Aduro, these are, you know, from physically specimens. And we just got done working out today, and he's doing a one-on-one post-defense drill with those guys, and holding his own and battling and seeing if he can get the advantage stretching the floor on the other.
Yeah, and you mentioned the physicality. Anyone who watched you guys last year know that going up against Josh Oduro in practice has got to be a physical nightmare for just about anyone.
Yeah, and we got to get more physical. You know, if from a rebounding standpoint, we'd like to, you know, try to offensive rebound a little bit better. Give Josh some help. You know, we couldn't be as physical as we wanted to be just because the makeup of our roster in year one wasn't, you know, what we wanted to look like moving forward.
Yeah, and one guy that could certainly help you with that, and I do not want to mispronounce his first name, so please correct me if I'm wrong. It is Ginika Ogiako, correct?
Yeah.
So he comes in, grad transfer from Virginia Tech, 6'10". He's a guy that can help you play some more two big lineups, can help you slide Devontae Gaines down to the three, which I can't even imagine how much of a menace he will be on the boards going up against small forwards next year. But how does he help kind of change the makeup of this team and help with your physicality?
You know, when you look at the makeup of the league the last year, the best teams in the league, you know, Davidson was Manenga and Brajkovic, you know, Dayton had spells of Kamara and Holmes. You know, it was St. Louis. It was teams that were big down, VCU. It was teams that were big down low. And I just think there's something to having someone you could throw it into in the post to get efficient offense, you know, offensive rebounding and defensive rebound. You know, so we'll absolutely, you know, play a good bit of games, you know, with Ginika and Josh together. Told him that in recruiting. And he was a very, very, very important get for us. It was probably the most important grab of the spring.
Yeah, and he's a guy who I think has kind of gone a little bit under the radar, just between the highly touted freshman and then Victor Bailey, all coming in pretty quick. He was still a quick get, but people had already started kind of eye up what the Patriots roster is going to look like. So hopefully he's someone that people start to realize is going to make a big impact on this team.
Yeah, well, we'll see. You know, we'll wait till November 7th and, you know, 11th and 13th, and we'll see. You know, preseason expectations are what they are, but what really matters is when the ball is tipped up 7 o'clock on November 7th.
Yeah, and one guy who's going to make a huge difference from November 7th on is your potential player of the year candidate, reigning first team All-A-10 center in Josh Oduro. And he went into the NBA draft process this year, withdrew fairly late, and I know George Mason fans really breathed a sigh of relief that he is coming back. They were, some of the ones I talked to as far back as March were worried that he was going to be gone. So I want to ask you, because you have a very unique perspective on this as someone who was a second-round pick, who fought his way on to earning a roster spot with the Detroit Pistons. Is there anything that you can take from that experience and your path to the NBA as a rookie that you feel like can be a help in getting Josh to develop this year? Because I assume that the NBA is probably his goal for next season.
Yeah, it is. It was, you know, the draft process this year was more getting the feedback and experience from teams. You know, it's with the combine, you know, being at a different time, and a lot of teams were having workouts after the combine, so that's why I went so late. And he had a workout with the Wizards. And I just, for me, honestly, if I didn't go through the process as a junior, I'm not sure I would have been drafted as a senior. Take aside, you know, the individual things, the collective things we did as a team my senior year, but the experience of knowing what those workouts felt like helped me a ton. And I'm hoping that it serves the same purpose for Josh next spring. But we have a lot of basketball, you know, before that can really help set himself up. And I think it's understood the best player in the Atlantic 10 is always an NBA player. I think you can look back, you can do, you know, I think Vince Williams was the best player in our league this past year, and he's with the Memphis Grizzlies. You know, before that it was Bones Highland. Before that it was Obi Toppin. Before that, I don't know DeAndre Bembry, whoever. You know, but the best player in this league is a pro, and I think there's a lot of guys that are at the that are vying for that spot as the best player in the A-10.
Yeah, and we don't have to go too deep into that right now, but all I know is that anyone who loves A-10 basketball will have the Josh Aduro, Deron Holmes showdown between George Mason and Dayton marked on their calendar, because that's a game that could certainly go a long way in determining who that best player is going to be. So I want to kind of move into your career and ending up at George Mason. And Matt dug up this fantastic quote that's on your bio from former Sixers general manager Sam Hinkie, who said, "Kim was 25 and I called his agent about him becoming a coach with the Sixers. It was clear even then that he had what it takes. George Mason is getting a good one." Obviously, at age 25, you were still playing off overseas. And so I want to throw in this question from Matt. Said, "You've been coaching at the high D1 level for 7 years before you took this George Mason job. Why was this the job that you felt like was the one to take you into transitioning to become a head coach?"
It's why not, truthfully. I just think that it's so much upside at Mason. I could go into a soliloquy about how great of a place this is, institutionally, you know, aside from basketball. You know, for George Mason to achieve Research One University status in less than 50 years as a university, you know, it just shows the innovation, the forward thinking, the excellence that's happening at this university. Obviously, what happened in 2006 with Coach Larrañaga, which led to the move to the Atlantic 10. I just think the upside of this place was phenomenal. During the process, I was involved with another job in a football league. And Rick Barnes, he asked me, we were in the NCAA tournament bubble, and he said, "Would you rather that job or George Mason?" He said, don't take anything else into consideration except for the job. And I said, I'd rather be at George Mason. Because I really believe in the trajectory of this place, you know, and I'm really excited about it. Excited about where George Mason is going to be in the next 10 years.
Yeah, and we've certainly seen where it can be, and we've seen what the fan support looks like when this team is at its best. It's a pretty great fan base that has kind of petered out a little bit in the past few years. This team hasn't finished in the top four since they've joined the A-10. So if that can happen here next year, pretty soon, it does feel like a place that could really turn into a great home court again.
Yep.
So was there any kind of regional consideration when you took this job? You haven't coached anywhere kind of in this D.C., Virginia, Maryland area. Were you worried at all about recruiting? And if you don't mind, I mentioned something about your assistant coaches local to the area, because you told a great story about assembling your staff on the By George pod. And if anyone didn't hear that, I think they should.
Yeah. I mean, I'm from this area. I was born and raised in Baltimore, so I lived here my whole life until I went to college. The area was the biggest bonus. I think the best players in America live here in this region. You know, it's a home base for recruiting. I think you can make a living off of kids from here. I mean, the Final Four team are all young players from local high schools, you know, Oxon Hill, Springbrook, St. Joseph's. You know, they were all local kids. So the recruiting here has been great. Obviously, Devin Dinkins from Gonzaga, D.C., D.C. Premier, Justin Fernandez from Richmond, but played AAU in D.C., and hopefully we get another local guy in this class. But yeah, really, really, really excited about the region. Kennecott played AAU basketball with Team Thrill in Baltimore. So there's a lot of local ties and a lot of great players. And yeah, our staff is great. Nate Thomason, who I've known since we competed against each other in prep school and in college. He played at Colorado, played pro for 6 seasons. We worked together on staff at Colorado. He can do whatever he wants in basketball. If he wants to go the front office route, I think he could be an NBA head coach. He's a brilliant basketball coach and a hardworking recruiter with strong ties internationally. He's from Australia. Dennis Felton, who I competed against when I played at Missouri. He was the head coach at Georgia. He was formerly the head coach at Western Kentucky. We worked together at the University of Tulsa, where I got to really work with him up close for 2 seasons and watch his level of meticulousness and attention to detail. But excited to have that veteran presence, especially embarking on a career. I was 32 years old when I got the job. I'll be 34 next month. So having his, you know, his wisdom around has been great for me to help me with potential blind spots. And Dwayne Simpkins, you know, was the last hire, if you will, but he was here when I got here. And as I, when we got the job and I just called around, talked to high school coaches, just small talk, and it was not a, you know, this wasn't anything that was, you know, strategized, but I got so many unsolicited, really, really good remarks about Dwayne Simpkins. And upon coming here, I wanted 2 things in a quote unquote local hire, because I'm a local hire. I feel really good in any local AAU or high school circles because I'm from just 30 minutes away. But I wanted someone with ties to the area, but also someone that I could trust immensely. And quickly meeting Coach Simpkins, I felt that trust. I felt the respect that people had for him. He played for two Naismith Hall of Fame coaches, and Gary Williams and Morgan Wooten at DeMatha Catholic. So we decided that we wanted to, you know, offer Simp the job, and really, really happy. And he had some other things going. I mean, his name came up at Tennessee when I left. His name, you know, was one of the first names that was kind of getting floated around to replace me with the Vols. But when he stayed, we quickly realized of the incredible value that we did have in having him. We get on these Zoom calls with prospects and they're asking us questions, not about basketball, not about us, not about the way we play, but about dining on campus or where the dorms are on campus. And 3 days in, we did not have the answer to those questions. So it was really cool to have someone with that institutional knowledge. He had been a coach here for 6 seasons under Coach Dave Paulson. So was very, very fortunate to retain Coach Simp.
Yeah, and it's a very good staff all around, but the Simpkins story was something that I really just delighted in hearing when you told it on the By George pod. Just kind of a great story of how a guy can get hired sometimes. So I want to close out your kind of coaching philosophy with this. You're obviously a young coach. You're studying up just like your players are. Someone like Josh Aduro is probably studying good big men that he wants to emulate. So who is a coach that you study, whether it's in terms of team building or tactics or just in their locker room philosophy?
Yeah, well, the guys I've been around, I've got to study up close, you know, an apprenticeship with Rick Barnes and Tad Boyle and Frank Hay, you know, Mike Anderson, who coached me at Missouri. So I always have a keen eye to, and a mindset to what I remember from those guys and learn from those guys. But as I've grown and I continue to watch Bill Self, you know, at Kansas, Shaka Smart and Marquette from a leadership standpoint, an enthusiasm standpoint, what he did in a basketball way at VCU, at Marquette, at Texas, Jay Wright, I'd say, Kelvin Sampson, those 4 guys are probably who I spend the most time watching learning from, listening to, seeing what they have on YouTube, sitting next to them on the road, talking at AAU games, watching their post-game press conferences, and just seeing what I can grab, watching them on Synergy. I mean, watching them on my TV screen at night. I'd say Houston, Villanova, Marquette, and Kansas are the programs outside of Colorado, Tennessee, and Tulsa, St. John's, who I follow because I have to.
Yeah, and that's a bunch of coaches who have either built up great programs, like Kelvin Sampson. Obviously, Houston was great a long time ago, but he built them up from a struggling point. And then a few coaches who have taken over fantastic programs and kept them at incredible heights. And all of them have done it without the benefit of being attached to some big-time football school, which obviously you are trying to do at George Mason as well. So we'll close it out with this. Let's say it's late March here, and you're thinking back on the season that you've just had, like late March into the future. What is something that you feel like needs to occur this year for George Mason's season to be a success?
Yeah, I think we need to take, and we will, better pride in our, on the defensive end of the ball. We need to take much more pride taking care of the ball. I think those two things will help us mightily. Our offensive efficiency, or if you want to say effective field goal percentage, when we got a shot, it was pretty good when we got a shot. And we'll continue to improve on the quality of our shots. But, if we take care of the ball, it gets us a better chance at making, effective field goals. And if we take much better pride in our defense, it will help us the other way. And if we do that, if we take care of the ball, we'll get good shots. And if we defend with more vigor and fight and tenacity, and again, back to an earlier point, with the depth, I expect that to be better. I think late March, we may still be playing, and hopefully when the season is over, we can look back and be proud of, round two.
Yeah, you already had a top five offense in the A-10 last year. Most of those key scorers are returning, so we'll see what happens with those improvements on the defensive side of the ball and more depth and how far that can take the Patriots this year. Coach English, thank you for joining me.
All right, thanks a lot, Tyler. Appreciate it.
All right, another thank you to Coach English for stopping by. And you know what? It appears I've found Matt, and he's brought the mailbag with him.
I did bring the mailbag, so sorry to everyone. I'm sure you'd rather continue listening to Coach English, but now you get me, so it is what it is there. But yeah, Tyler, let's go ahead and continue the mailbag. And I think a good place to start, toward the end of your discussion, you asked Coach what would constitute a successful season for George Mason this year. And we got a good question from the D is on Fire podcast asking us, what's a successful season for the Atlantic 10 this year? And specifically, what are the conference's postseason expectations? So I'll let you start with this one.
Well, I think the postseason expectations are what dictates a successful season. So I'm going to put three prongs to this. Number one, you need to get three teams in the NCAA tournament this year, with the top two potentially being as good as they look. And the fact that we know someone from the middle will emerge as a better team than we expect. You got to put at least six total in either the NCAA tournament or the NIT, although it looks like A-10 teams don't really play in the other tournaments anyway. And then you got to win, and this is the toughest one of all, I think you got to win two NCAA tournament games this year, whether it's two different teams getting to the second round or someone getting to the Sweet 16.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much exactly what I had for this. I mean, for the first part, we wouldn't be here if we didn't want the A-10 to get at least three bids. I mean, I don't think it's fair to set the expectation any higher than that because it hasn't happened in 4 years. But three teams should be really the bare minimum, especially with Loyola Chicago joining the conference. That's another bona fide tournament contender joining the league, a solid program that should help out other teams' resumes and just overall give everyone a stronger schedule. But I also like what you said, getting six total postseason teams is important too. And I think this gets overlooked by a lot of people, but a pretty good mark of the strength of a mid-major conference or high-major conference is the number of NIT teams you get. And for a lot of these, like, you know, if Dayton or St. Louis, or I would still say VCU, if they go to the NIT, that's not what their fans want. That's not what the program wants. But if someone like a George Mason or a Rhode Island or a UMass, teams that haven't seen postseason basketball in a while, someone like that making the NIT, I think, would be a very good season. And it would benefit the A-10 as a whole to have some of them play in the postseason for the first time in a while. So I think you hit the nail on the head.
So just piggybacking right off of that immediately, I think there's five teams that realistically could make the NIT where doing so would definitely be a success this year.
Yeah.
George Mason hasn't made the postseason since they joined the A-10.
They made the CBI 1 year, I think.
Yeah, but the A-10 doesn't even send teams to the CBI that often anymore.
They might have been the last ones, honestly.
Yeah, that's a win. Rhodey and UMass were so bad last year and so bad the last few years that if they can quick rebuild their way into the NIT in year one, that's a win. If Richmond, after losing all those seniors and this young team with Matt Grace and some transfers and Andre Gustafson makes it to the NIT, that's a win. And Davidson, the fact that they lost three starters, including two all-conference guys and their Hall of Fame coach, I still think they actually can make the NCAA tournament, but if that young team with Foster Lawyer and a first-year coach makes the NIT, I think that's a win for them too.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know as much about them as I should, but I even think Loyola joining the A-10, moving up a conference and turning over a good amount of their tournament team last year, I feel like the NIT wouldn't even be a terrible result for them, although they could end up doing better too.
I can't tell how I feel about Loyola yet.
They're on the fence.
I've oscillated multiple times for what I feel like a reasonable expectation should be for them, because it's a weird roster with a lot of new and inexperienced guys, but they also have two absolute studs coming back in the backcourt. And just having Norris and Kennedy, I wanted to call him Towns. That was from the Elite Eight team. Just having Norris and Kennedy back means that they should have reasonably high expectations. But the bigger thing is the conference as a whole should have high expectations this year. Like, we set forth things that haven't happened the last few years, but this is the highest talent level's been probably since the six bid year of 2013. And for anyone who wants to say that, oh, like four would be insane and mid-majors shouldn't even be shooting for three, the Mountain West literally got four last year. According to KenPom, the A-10 and the Mountain West aren't that different. So if they can do that in their peak year, the A-10 should be able to do similar in their peak year. Although the Mountain West also went 0-4 in the NCAA tournament. And although Fresno State won whatever the CIT is now called.
Yeah, that's what I did want to add on. As soon as you brought up the Mountain West from last year, what a great regular season for that conference. And then it all crashed and burned immediately in the NCAA tournament. But I think that brings back to your last point. We don't just need to get teams to the postseason, but we need to have some success too. And Richmond did win a game last year, making it to the round of 32. That was huge. We missed the chance for Dayton 2 years ago when they likely would have at least made a run into the second weekend, maybe further. But you have to go all the way back to 2014 when Dayton made the Elite Eight, and then 2013 when LaSalle made the Sweet 16. That's the last time we've seen an A-10 team go deep into March. And, you know, I don't know if we're going to get one team winning multiple games. Hopefully we do at least get two teams past the first round. But recently, there just hasn't been a whole lot to celebrate besides, I mean, I guess the Bonnies made a deep run last year in the NIT, but that's not what we were going for.
And look, there are teams here that should feel like if they hit their peak, they can make the Sweet 16.
Oh, well, if they hit their
And
peak,
I don't think we
absolutely.
would have said that 2 years ago or 4 years ago.
No, well, I mean, 2 years ago, VCU was like preseason top 25. Like, I feel like we've definitely had
3 years
these
ago, they
discussions
were.
every year. Oh, you're right. You're right. 3 years ago. I feel like we've had this discussion about every year, though, where going in, it looks like there's a couple teams that could be really spooky good. And this year, it's Dayton and St. Louis. It just hasn't really worked out, although maybe this will be the year. And that is what'll set the bar for a successful season, for sure. So, all right. Unless you have anything else, I think we can move into our second question of the night, coming up from our friends at the Goalless Standard. And they asked us, will any of the Pillow Fight teams make it out of this season's bottom six? And if so, who? And I think we just need to address this too. We're assuming that six teams make the Pillow Fight this year with the new realignment, right?
Yeah. And I actually want to address this before we even get into this question, because the more I think about it, it just kind of feels wonky to have six pillow fight teams out of 15.
It
If you
is
think about
weird.
it last year, if the bottom six are in the pillow fight, that includes that feel good Fordham team. And it just feels wrong to call them a pillow fighter. So I am petitioning right now that the pillow fight, or if we can come up with something more derogatory, Petey Buckets, get on it. The pillow fight is used to classify the three teams who do not make it to the second round, as opposed to the six who play in the first round.
I don't know about that though, because like, what if Duquesne or somebody goes 1-17 again, but beats the 10 seed? Like, that's.
I think the A10 has shown us that when a team is that bad, they're not beating the 10 seed.
They might. I mean, crazy things have happened in the A10 tournament. You never know.
I'm thinking of it more of the flip of if a normal 10 seed is gonna easily have a chance to make it into the quarterfinals and then be competitive against the 2 seed.
I don't know. Well, I think that this is a discussion for another day. Like, we can, once we even figure out how the bracket's going to look, I think we can figure this
I
out.
think we
But
can assume it'll be that way, but
I think you're right.
the A10
But
doesn't exactly go outside the box on things like this.
no. So, going into the Goalless Standards question, though, last year's Pillow Fighters were Rhode Island, St. Joe's, LaSalle, and Duquesne. To start out, I think Rhode Island is the pretty safe answer. I have them as a solid top half team right now. I just think they've got enough talent. They've got a good coach. Fairly safe from the, well, nobody's safe right now, but I think they're in the best position to avoid the bottom six.
I wanted to evaluate this on the four teams that everyone's basically calling pillow fighters right now,
Oh, okay.
which is
Who are the
GW in place of Rhode Island. Because Rhode Island's too easy. Like, they have Archie freaking Miller as their coach. They just brought in a stud young point guard who was on the all freshman team on a better A-10 team last year. They just brought in a guy who was a five-star recruit going to North Carolina. Like, Rhodey's just in a different tier than the rest of these teams right now. So, honestly, I think the question's more interesting if we approach it that way. And if
All
we do
right.
so, my pick is Duquesne. The roster sneaky got a decent amount of talent this year. First off, there is no, absolutely no chance that they're going to be as bad as last year. That roster never made sense from the jump. And so it actually kind of helps them that it basically got gutted. The one guy who absolutely had to come back did, and that was Trey Williams, who now should have the freedom to control more of the offense with the fact that he should have real point guards around him actually feeding him the ball. He's a great defensive anchor. And I feel really good about the backcourt that they have coming in right now. Day-Day Grant from Miami of Ohio, Tevin Brewer from Florida International. Two proven high double-digit scoring guards who can also pass the ball, both good assist guys. Like, they're just going to be so much better than last year. And the other three, I don't see a reason to really believe in growth this season. Also, we should remember, that was Keith Dambrot's first losing season at any level in 29 years. He is not going to take this offseason lightly, because I guarantee you he is waking up every morning thinking about not going below 500 again next season.
Yeah, I think Duquesne, I think on the surface, people are going to hear us talk up Duquesne and think that's ridiculous, but I think you made some good points. Look, when you only win one conference game, I think it's an all right thing that the Dukes are pretty much turning over their entire roster. But like you said, they have an extremely legitimate backcourt, kind of similar to what we saw from Fordham last year when they brought in two really good mid-major scoring guards. That's what Duquesne has done. And, you know, last year, you're right, it sticks out like a sore thumb on Keith Dambrot's head coaching resume. Every other year that he's been with Duquesne in the A-10, they've at least competed and, you know, finished near the middle of the pack. And I think they're going to get closer to that than people realize. Looking at the other options here, I think GW with a new coach, losing a couple key guards, I think they would have a tough time. St. Joe's is just, I mean, we know that they've been able to assemble a decent amount of freshman talent over the last couple of years, but without Taylor Funk and Jordan Hall, I don't really see them having enough in the tank. LaSalle is a little bit interesting, kind of along the lines of Dambrot. Now you've got a very good veteran head coach in Fran Dunphy. He didn't come back out of retirement to lose a bunch of games. I don't think he would have taken the job if he didn't think that he had a chance to make LaSalle competitive again. The problem is they just lost a decent amount from a pretty bad team last year. And really, I think what it's going to come down to, they have an interesting recruiting class, a lot of international prospects, and it's kind of hard to find a ton of information on how well they're going to be able to compete at the A-10 level. But, you know, if one or two of their freshmen break out, you build that around Quisenberry and Brickus, a couple good guards in the backcourt, maybe LaSalle ascends out of that range. But I agree with what you said. I think Duquesne is the other pick here.
Yeah, GW, it's going to be rough in Caputo's first year. Unless Bishop just goes up a notch as a player, I just don't think they have the overall talent right now. St. Joe's, it kind of feels like they're building to be a sneaky, potentially good team next year, which I guess is good for them if Billy Lang has job security, which who knows at this point.
Yeah.
LaSalle, like, I don't want to bet against Fran Dunphy either. He's a great coach. I'm also not sure Peak John Wooden could get LaSalle to the middle of the pack in 1 year right now. It's a disaster. And if they had kept Clifton Moore and Jack Clark, it's not as much of a disaster. But they didn't. Like, they bring back two intriguing guards who, I guess three, because Brantley, Nickelberry, and Brickus are all back. But they bring back three intriguing guards who have also just kind of left us all with a little bit of disappointment. None of them have reached their ceiling yet. I think Dunphy gets through to one of them, but even if he gets through to one of them, like, what else is there?
Yeah, and I think this whole discussion too just reminds me, like, we talked up how there are some high ceiling A-10 teams, but man, the bottom of the conference is going to be pretty rough once again this year. And I hate throwing them under the bus, but we didn't mention Fordham. I think they could be right down here too. I didn't want to group them in because they were legitimately a 500 team last year, but you know, they lose a lot of talent as well and have a new coach.
We'll talk deeper about Fordham later, but one of the keys to the A-10 hitting its expectations, they need the two New York teams to at least be competent somewhere near the middle of the pack.
Oh, yeah, the bodies.
And they need one of the three Pennsylvania teams to be decent. Because if all three of them are flaming dumpster fires like last year, then there's just too many landmines, and eventually someone, Dayton, will step on one of them.
Yeah. God, that reminds me too. How about the Bonnies team preview? How do you think that's gonna go? I mean, there's not much to go off this year. Like, we haven't even talked about St. Bonaventure's a pillow fight team, but I mean, it's possible.
It will be 9.5 minutes dedicated to figuring out why Justin and Jacques Trigiore was the one guy who wanted to stay.
Yeah, we'll have to get him
He
on the
must love the
pod.
Bonnies.
Who doesn't? All right. Well, those are some good questions, and we're going to keep answering them throughout the preseason. Hopefully, have some other good episodes coming up. But anything else to wrap it up, Tyler?
No, I'll just leave it on this. You said people might not think that Duquesne's going to be decent this year. It should be remembered they only kept three guys from last year, but it was their two best guys and the one bench player who was actually a reliable, steady hand in Austin Rotrov. So they kept the pieces that you wanted to see them keep, and other than that, it was a complete teardown. So they got a lot of mystery surrounding them, but the ceiling's a lot higher than it would have been if it was just the same roster.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, I don't have too much else, but excited for the season. We're getting closer and should be a fun ride. Couple good episodes coming on up. Can't wait to get into these team previews. I started actually doing some research last week too. I feel a little bit more educated as we approach September.
Yeah, the deep dives will be coming in October. We hopefully got some more great guests for you guys in September. But if you want to hear another great guest, go back, listen to our episode with Daryl Davis from earlier this week, if you haven't already, talking about TBT, his career at Dayton, his time playing overseas. He was just an absolute delight to talk to. So go back and listen to that if you haven't yet. Big thank you to him. Big thank you to Coach English for giving us some time today. And a big thank you to everyone who has continued to listen to us over the summer. If you enjoyed the show, please give us 5 stars on iTunes and leave us a review. And keep checking back to the feed. We will be bringing you more new episodes as we head towards the season. And everyone listening to this out on their Labor Day weekend, I hope you enjoy it.
And I care and bit our thumb.